Welcome back to lecture seven. Okay, welcome back to lecture seven. So last time, you know, we had a sort of conceptual introduction to spontaneous symmetry breaking for global symmetries, and then for gauge symmetries. Well, actually, we didn't quite finish that, so I'll get to that as the first thing now. So in the gauge symmetry case, spontaneous symmetry breaking corresponds to this phenomenon, the Higgs phenomenon. And in the standard model, the gauge symmetry that's broken is the electroweak, or SU2 times U1 part of the gauge symmetry. So this is electroweak symmetry breaking. So then for the rest of the lecture, what I want to do is actually then see how it manifests itself in the real, honest to God, standard model Lagrangian, and how at the field theory level we actually see the thing which we were describing more conceptually as a first step. Okay, so just to remind you, this is the you know, second to last slide of the previous lecture. We started by reviewing the spontaneous symmetry breaking for a global symmetry. Upshot was this idea of Goldstone's theorem, that if we divide the full symmetry group of the theory, or its Lie algebra V, into this, so that was in the standard model, that's this 12-dimensional Lie algebra SU3 color times SU2 left times U1 hypercharge. That when one or more of the scalar fields in the theory get a vacuum expectation value, this guy over here, that is not invariant under the full group, then we can split it into the original symmetries into a sub, or the original Lie algebra into a subalgebra W, which in this case is SU3 times SU3 color times U1 electric charge. This subalgebra, which when it acts on the vacuum, it annihilates it. So when we exponentiate it, in other words, those symmetries, SU3 times U1 electromagnetism, they just leave the vacuum alone. It's invariant under those symmetries. But then there are the remaining, in this case, three dimensions of symmetries, which are the quotient space V mod W, that do not leave H invariant. And so, in other words, those Lie algebra elements do not annihilate H, and so those corresponding symmetries do not leave H invariant. They would move it around on the vacuum manifold in one way or another. By the way, I just have a little note here, which I forgot to explain last time. So you probably remember this from your linear algebra class, but just to remind you what V mod W means. If you have a vector space V and then some subspace W, V mod W is the set of the vector space of equivalence classes, V brackets. V bracket is the equivalence class of the vector V, where that equivalence class is all vectors in the vector space V that are of the form V plus W, where W is any element of the space we're modding out. So changing you by an arbitrary, adding an arbitrary amount of a vector W from the subspace W does not change the equivalence class. And so in this context, you know, the reason that is what's relevant is because if you have some vector which doesn't annihilate H, instead gives you know, when acting on the VEV of H, gives some value, well, changing it, adding a little bit of W to it won't change the value that you get, because that part will just annihilate H. So really what the answer is when you act with this when you act with an element on the VEV H, well, it only depends on what equivalence class of V mod W you're in. Doesn't change when you add an arbitrary amount of the vector W from the vector space capital W. So to make a long story short, we saw that in the global case, we had these for every dimension of V mod W, for every generator that does not act trivially on H, does not annihilate H, we get a massless scalar field, a massless scalar particle called the Goldstone boson, one for each broken generator, and that's what Goldstone's theory is. And then I briefly said this, but I just want to say it in a not so rushed way. So what happens now when we take the real case where the standard model has not a global symmetry, but a gauge symmetry that's getting spontaneously broken? Well, then instead of Goldstone's theorem, we get the so-called Higgs mechanism. Okay, so what's the story here? Okay, so now, first to explain it, first I want to take the Higgs field, which again started out as a field with two complex components, so four real numbers, phi 1 plus I phi 2, phi 3 plus I phi 4. But then I can use the gauge symmetry to rotate it around. I have I can rotate. I can take a, you know, if at some point in space, it's pointing it's in some direction along the three sphere, I can use my SU2 times U1 gauge symmetry to rotate it over that point in space to point in whatever direction I want on the three sphere. So above every point in space now, I'm going to use my freedom to take the symmetry transformation above that point in space and rotate it. So it's always pointing in this direction. It's always pointing in the same direction. So above every point in space, I'm going to take it to have to set both the real and imaginary parts of the upper component to zero, and to set the imaginary part of the lower component to zero. So the lower component is just a real value. And then I'm going to, again, split that real value into the vacuum expectation value, the constant part right at the bottom of the potential here, and a fluctuating part, capital H, which will be, so this V here will now be, it's called the Higgs VEV. My pen stopped working. Uh-oh. Is called the Higgs VEV. E is called the Higgs VEV, and H now is the Higgs boson. That's the actual particle that was discovered at CERN several years ago. And this choice, this choice of fixing the SU2 times U1 part of the gauge symmetry is called unitary gauge. It's a very commonly used way to describe the physics of the standard model. Okay. So good. So now the story is rather parallel. We start with V, our full Lie algebra, SU3 color times plus SU2 left plus U1 hypercharge. Again, that's 8 plus 3 plus 1 equals 12 dimensions. Once again, just as before, we have now a subalgebra, SU3 color plus U1 electromagnetism that annihilates H. Nothing has changed about this. This is exactly the same story from the previous slide. That's a 9D subalgebra. And so here are the generators in W. Well, the SU3 generators are the 8 Gell-Mann matrices. These are these 3x3 generators of SU3. And then again, like we saw last time, the generator of the one-dimensional electromagnetic group here, Lie algebra, Q, which is what we know as the electric charge. That's actually the sum of the third generator of SU2 and the hypercharge generator. We saw that particular combination, if we acted on the vector 0V, okay, that's supposed to say 0V. No. Anyway, okay, so that combination annihilates that vector. This is the so-called electric charge generator. These lambda I's are the gauge fields that are multiplying them are the gluons, and the gauge field multiplying the electric charge is called the photon. So those gluons G mu I, there's 8 of them. And the photon is conventionally called A mu. And these are the 9 unbroken gauge symmetry in the standard model. And physically, the unbroken symmetries in a gauge theory, those corresponding particles remain massless, so they don't get a mass. We'll see that later in the lecture. And then they're called vector bosons because, well, they're vector fields. Just that's just referring to the fact that they have, one Lorentz index. And so physically, these particles will have two physical degrees of freedom. You know, this is the fact that the photon can be polarized either vertically or horizontally. Or you could say that it can have right or left circular polarization. But it, what it can't do is it can't have a polarization, can't have any component of its polarization pointing along the direction of the direction in which an electromagnetic wave is moving. So it has only 2 degrees of freedom, or in terms of its spin, it has photons can have helicity plus or minus one. Their angular momentum is one, and it has to either point exactly along or exactly counter to their momentum. Whereas, if we now look at the remaining three generators, instead of becoming Goldstone bosons, what now happens in the gauge theory case, in the Higgs mechanism case, is that, so if we look at these remaining 12 minus 9 equals 3 dimensional space of generators, this quotient space, the ones that don't annihilate H, so these are the broken generators in the theory. So we say electroweak symmetry is broken in the standard model. And then there's this terminology that's commonly used. People say that instead of having, so we have these three, we used to have these three massless Goldstone bosons, these massless scalar fields in the global symmetry breaking case. But now we also have the three corresponding gauge fields corresponding to those generators. And people, what happens is that those three corresponding generators or gauge fields each quote unquote eat one of the Goldstone bosons. They incorporate it into, you define a new composite field, which is made of the gauge field and the scalar field. And consequently, they become massive vector bosons. Okay, and so this is called the Higgs mechanism. We're going to see exactly how this works in more detail later in the lecture. But so these three guys that eat a Goldstone boson and become massive, these are the so-called weak vector bosons in the standard model. They're the W plus boson, the W minus boson, and the Z zero boson. And they're called vector bosons again because they each have one Lorentz index mu. Okay, yeah. So here. Oh, and so these are the bosons corresponding to the broken symmetries in the standard model. They're called massive vector bosons. I'm repeating myself here, but so physically now, instead of, unlike a massless vector boson which has only 2 degrees of freedom, two polarizations, these massive ones will have 3 degrees of freedom. They can either have helicity plus or minus one like before, but they can also have helicity zero. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When we say, excuse me, when we say the, I just want to understand, what is the unbroken electroweak symmetry group from the standard? Is it SU2 cross U1 or?
The unbroken? The part of electroweak that doesn't get broken is just electromagnetism. So we started with SU2 times U1, which was, SU2 is a three-dimensional group and U1 is a one-dimensional group. So we started with four dimensions in total in the electroweak sector. In other words, if we set aside QCD, set aside the strong force, and three of those end up acting non-trivially on the Higgs BEV, so they are broken. Those become the W mu, W plus, W minus, and Z bosons. And then the remaining one unbroken guy out of the original four becomes the photon. So it's just the gauge boson of electromagnetism, which is the remaining unbroken part. Yes.
From the first line, observationally, we have observed H, not V, for Higgs, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And
but the effect, we'll see that we've seen the effects of V. I mean, we have observed that V. The fact that, the for example, the fermions have masses and the Higgs boson, and the W and Z bosons have masses. They all have masses that are proportional to V. So their non-zero values of their masses are in a sense, all indications that V is not. Then, yeah.
So the evidence for this symmetry breaking is that these guys are massive, W and Z.
Yes, that's right. So, yes, exactly. So I mean, there's this whole, at this, by this point, there's this whole, you know, edifice of the standard model that the full theory has this larger SU2 times U1 gauge symmetry that is then not observed at low energies. So there's really just tons of different ways that there's evidence for that now. But indeed, I mean, one of the essential points is that, you know, people is exactly what you said. That if the symmetry, you know, the way, let's say historically the way people came to it, the way Glashow and Weinberg came to it was, they said, you know, we observe these weak forces in nature, mediated by massive particles, which appear to be mediated by massive particles. They hadn't actually detected those particles directly yet, but indirectly they could see the forces they were mediating. They could see that the particles had to be massive because the forces they were mediating were so short range. But then they realized they couldn't write down a proper renormalizable theory of those forces and the standard model fermions, just based on those massive theories. And so it was Glashow and, anyway, a combination of people had this insight that, oh, we could make it renormalizable if secretly they came from massless gauge bosons. There was a bigger symmetry, and they only appear massive because of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So that's sort of how they historically arrived at this model. But then now it makes many, many, many different predictions that one tests. So it's the evidence now is somehow is much, much, much more many-sided story. Okay, so before jumping into showing how to rewrite the standard model Lagrangian in its symmetry broken form, let's just clean up how we wrote the standard model Lagrangian. So in particular, the fermionic part. So here we have I'm writing again our beloved Lagrangian for the full standard model, including right-handed neutrinos. So I want to make a couple comments. First of all, I just want to make sure I fix an error that I made before. I think in one of my first lectures on Yang-Mills, I was normalizing the prefactor here with a 1/4, because in the U1 case, in electromagnetism, it's a 1/4. But you know, when the trace is in the expression here, actually the conventional thing is actually to have a 1/2 here, because then, as we'll see in a later slide, when we take the normalization of the generators, the trace of a pair of generators to have a 1/2 in front of it, that 1/2 will combine with this 1/2 to give a 1/4 when we write it out in the basis when we expand in terms of generators. Anyway, it's just a detail, but just because it'll be annoying when you're trying to check things if these should be 1/2s. Okay, so fine. But the main thing I wanted to describe was how to clean up this part a bit, which will be the two fermion lines, which will be helpful in understanding the physics. So first of all, we discussed this a bit when we were discussing writing down the Lagrangian, but you know, we noticed that in this line we're writing down, you know, just a QI times QI term. But what would have prevented us? And you know, here we're just writing down UI times UI. But what it doesn't seem like gauge invariance or Lorentz invariance prevents us from writing down QI bar times QJ. So why didn't we write down terms like that? Why are we just writing down these sort of diagonal terms that are diagonal in family space, and not some more general thing like Q bar I contracted with Dirac operator times Q bar left times some arbitrary 3x3 matrix here, KIJ? Well, the answer is that we should start by writing down this more general thing, but then we have a freedom to redefine the fields in the Lagrangian to clean that up. So first of all, the fact that the Lagrangian has to be real, has to be equal to its own Hermitian conjugate, you can check forces this matrix K to be a Hermitian matrix. But then, For any Hermitian matrix K, we can always diagonalize it in the following form. We can write it as a real diagonal matrix times a unitary matrix and U dagger, where lambda is diagonal. And then what we do is we redefine a new set of fields. We make a rotation in the three family space, where we take the old fields, we multiply them by the matrix U and by lambda to the 1/2, and define those as our new fields QL prime. And we do that in all of these terms, and then we just drop the primes, and then that's how we get this line into this form where it's diagonal and with just a 1 in front of every term. So that's a good thing to check that you understand that point. Yeah.
The diagonalization of the quarks, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that, like, if we're experimentally speaking, the left-hand side is some linear combination of the Q fields, and the right-hand side is just what it is, and which one is the experimental, like, degree of freedom in some sense? For example, the same thing happens with neutrinos, where they get mixed by some mixing matrix.
Yeah, very good question. So at the moment, at the moment, we're just using our freedom to redefine change variables to make the Lagrangian look as simple as possible. And then, in principle, we can choose whatever degrees of freedom we want to describe the physics. But then, indeed, there's some that will have, you know, particular physical properties. And so the things we really, you know, care about at a collider usually are the so-called mass eigenstates of the theory. Those are the things that the particles that we usually want to describe as the lines in our Feynman diagrams are the so-called mass eigenstates of the free theory. So we'll be exactly getting to that. How to identify the mass eigenstates of the theory. But so far, as a first step, it's just good. We're free to choose variables that make the Lagrangian look as simple as possible. And then it will happen that those will also make, I mean, not surprisingly, those will also make the identification of the mass eigenstates simpler than if we had stayed in the more general. So far we've explained why there's no extra coefficients or matrices in this line, why it's diagonal in the IJ space. Okay, what about this line? Can we similarly redefine the fields to remove all the matrices Y? Well, not quite, but we can make the line a lot simpler. So now these matrices Y are not Hermitian matrices, because on this line, you know, again, we've been talking a lot about how the Lagrangian has to be gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant and possibly renormalizable, but I should have been emphasizing all along that it also has to be real. So every time I add any term to the Lagrangian, I have to also add its Hermitian conjugate. And in some cases, like this term, that's nothing different. And in some cases, like these terms, that the Hermitian conjugate is equal to the original term. But for these terms on this line, the Hermitian conjugate is a different term, you know, and we have to add it too. So that's why I have this plus Hermitian conjugate at the end of the line. So I'm just writing down this term Q left bar times H twiddle times U right, but the Hermitian conjugate of this term would be the terms all reversed, and so the Hermitian conjugate of this term would start with a U right bar. And then there would be an H twiddle dagger. There would be the complex conjugate, or the Hermitian conjugate of this matrix, and then Q left without a bar. That would be the dagger. So that term is one of these. So for each of these four terms, there's a corresponding sort of reversed conjugated term that I have to add to make the Lagrangian real. But the consequence of that is that the consequence of that is that this thing is not Hermitian matrix. It can just be an arbitrary 3x3 matrix to start with. So now I can't diagonalize it in the way that I did before, But instead, for any, you know, for any matrix, I can always do what's called a singular value decomposition. So for any matrix Y, I can always write it as two different. I can write it as V dagger, where V is a unitary matrix, and then U is a different unitary matrix. If it was a Hermitian matrix, V and U could have been the same thing, but now V and U are two separate matrices. And then again, times a diagonal matrix with real positive values along the diagonal. So this is called a singular value decomposition. So let me do that to each of these. Let me take each of my, so first of all, I'm going to focus just on the three Yukawas that I'm gonna start forgetting about these blue terms for the moment. Simplify life for the moment. First, just think about the minimal standard model without right-handed neutrinos. So for each of those three Yukawas, YU, YD, and YE, so that's YU, YD, YE here, I'm going to do a singular value decomposition. So for YU, the singular value decomposition will be some unitary matrix V sub U dagger times some real diagonal matrix little y sub U times some other unitary matrix capital U sub U, and then analogous decompositions for the other two matrices. And then now a good thing to check is that, okay, so just like I redefined the fields before, I can do another round where I redefine, instead of the original field U, right, I started with, I'll rotate it by the matrix capital U sub U, define a new field UR prime. And similarly, I'll define a new Q left prime field to be the old Q left field times VU. And what you can check is that, okay, so you see I'm still free to rotate. I'm still free to rotate my fields U and Q by a unitary matrix. Redefine them rotate in the three-dimensional family space by a unitary matrix, because you can check that that's the only thing I'm allowed to do in order to not spoil. You know, I went to all this trouble a moment ago to diagonalize this term and this term in family space to make the coefficient one. Yeah, so that only I is contracted with I and the coefficient in front of each term is one. So there's kind of a unitary matrix. There's an identity matrix giving the family contraction here and here. And whatever further rotations of the fields, redefinitions of the fields, I want to not mess that up. I want the rotations that simplify this line to not mess this line up again. So you should make sure you understand this, but that ends up forcing you to choose a unitary matrix here. As long as you choose a unitary, you're fine. Row two will remain okay. So I'll keep trying to play that game. We'll check in a moment that if I make this field redefinition, I will clean up this term and basically replace by basically replacing, if I again make this substitution, I switch from the fields U and Q to the fields U prime and Q prime that I just defined. That will basically convert this capital Y, which was a generic 3x3 matrix, into little y, which is just a 3x3 real diagonal matrix. Now I could try to do the same thing to clean up this guy, but I run into a problem, which is that if I try to, okay, no problem, I can rotate D right to find a new rotated version of D right called D right prime. Let me try to explain this better. So here, capital Y, we rewrote capital Y as V dagger little y U, and we redefined Q to absorb this V into this field, and we redefined U right to absorb this U matrix into this field. And so we were just left with the little y in the middle. So Now, if we try to play the same game over here with this term, well, we'll take this y, and that's this y, and we'll rewrite it as v dagger little y u, and you know, we can once again try to absorb this v into a redefinition of q, and this u into a redefinition of this d, be left with this little y in the middle, but we won't succeed because, okay, redefining d, that's fine. We can redefine d just like we did before to absorb the u, but redefining this q to absorb this v won't work because we've already redefined q. So when we if we tried to redefine q to absorb v, well, we would screw up our previous diagonalization of the previous term. So you see, we just don't have enough fields to do all the, to absorb all the v's and u's in the court case. So we'll see that that leaves us with a sort of unabsorbed unitary matrix called the CKM matrix on the next slide. But for the before I go on to that, I'll just say that for the leptons, we can do it. We take this capital Y. There's for the leptons, if there's no right-handed neutrinos, if this term is absent, then we just have this capital Y. We write it as V dagger Y U. We can absorb the V by redefining the lepton doublet. We can absorb the U, redefining the electron field. And so, to make a long story short, this is a good exercise to check. It's a little bit too messy for me to write out on the, I find it, there's some threshold of calculation past which I find that if I write it out in detail in class, I think people's eyes will glaze over. So instead, I just want to kind of describe what the calculation would be, and then I think these sorts of things are better to check on your own. I really recommend it. Just take a few minutes to check this, that if you make these redefinitions that we described on the previous page, if you make these singular value decompositions, and then these field redefinitions, and you just plug those in to the Lagrangian on the previous slide, and then drop the primes, you want to check that the lines now become, third line is now this diagonal line that we saw before, and the fourth line is now similar to the previous fourth line, but now in this term, I have not erased the J on this. Oh well, I'll do this afterwards. But so in this term nicely simplifies. Now the matrix is just a diagonal Yukawa matrix with just three entries. But in this term, we have the diagonal matrix, but then we have also this unremovable. You'll find when you just do the substitution that there's an extra unitary that's still sitting here that hasn't been removed. We haven't managed to diagonalize this part. This is the so-called CKM matrix, and it is given by VU, the matrix VU that appeared here, times VD dagger, the matrix that appeared in this second singular value decomposition. But then in the lepton term, we have managed to diagonalize. Okay. So, and then what we'll see in a moment, or when we get to spontaneous symmetry breaking, is that then when we replace these H's, when we split them into their VEV times their VEV plus the field part, the VEV multiplying this matrix becomes the mass matrix for the up quarks, and the VEV times this matrix becomes the mass matrix for the down quarks, and the VEV times this matrix becomes the mass matrix for the leptons. Okay, so that was all just to say that was all just to get us set up now to go ahead and rewrite things in the following slides. In the following way. So I want to split again the Lagrangian into the top two. Okay, so I'm going to just focus again for this lecture on the minimal standard model Lagrangian. I'm going to forget about this term for the rest of the lecture, and I'm going to split the Lagrangian into the top two lines, which are the bosons, and the next two lines, which are the fermions, and I'll treat those in two steps. So we want to see what the physical content of those two lines is when we plug in the VEV of the Higgs. Okay, so here's step one, the boson line. And again, this slide is crowded because I just want to kind of walk you through the steps, but not carry out the calculation explicitly, because then it's in this category where I think it's better if I explain how to do the calculation, and then you take each of these things I described would just take a couple of minutes to check on your own, but will probably make a lot more sense once you write them down for yourself. Okay, so good. So here's the standard model Lagrangian written out in full, the first two lines, and now what I want to extract again is I want to take the Higgs field, and I want to, everywhere in the Lagrangian, I want to split it into its, I want to make this substitution where I write it as its VEV plus the Higgs boson capital H. And then after I've done that, I want to, on this slide, just extract the part of the Lagrangian that is then quadratic in the fields and interpret that in terms of what particles are present and which ones are massive and which ones are massless. Okay, so let's first try to extract the quadratic terms on the first line. If you think about our expression for g mu nu here, you know, we said g mu nu was partial g minus partial g, and then plus a commutator of g with g. I want to do something else first. Excuse me, going out of order here. So the first thing I want to do is, like we did before, I want to re-express the gauge fields. I want to split them, write them in a basis of generators. So that the SU3 gauge field, I'll split into a basis of 8 gluons times the 8 generators of SU3, the Gell-Mann matrices, which are normalized like so. So the first thing to check is that when you take that relation and plug it in here, this becomes the following term, just basically it becomes minus a quarter times the diagonal sum of the 8 gluon terms, each of which is now a separate Yang-Mills-like Lagrangian, but I also want to only keep the quadratic parts. So, you know, if I think about G here, it's a combination of these two terms that are linear in G and this term that's quadratic in G. So if I want, when I square it down here, if I want to only get terms that are quadratic in the fields, I have to only take the terms in G mu nu that are linear in the fields. You know, so in other words, I can ignore, I can just drop these commutator terms, because when I square G mu nu, they would only give rise to cubic and quartic terms in the Lagrangian below. So in practice, G mu nu, if I'm only interested in the quadratic part of the Lagrangian in this slide, G mu nu is just this. So in other words, this line is really like a sum of 8 Maxwell-like terms for each of the gluon fields. It's exactly like the Maxwell Lagrangian we have here, but just one for each of the 8 gluons. And analogously for the W fields, we split them into their generators as before, where again those generators are normalized as follows. So you want to check that this term becomes this term, which is just a sum of 3 Maxwell-like terms. So we just have these basically eight copies of the Maxwell Lagrangian and so forth. If we just had this line, then that would describe, sorry, I think I said eight, but I meant 12, 8 plus 3 plus 1 Maxwell Lagrangians. We would have sort of 12 independent particles, each of which was just like a non-interacting photon, which is, was exactly like the photon. So then on the next line, if we take, let's try to expand the Higgs kinetic term. Now the Higgs kinetic term, again, our goal is to just extract the part of this that's quadratic in the fields. Well, so let's look just first at the covariant derivative. Let's expand out the covariant derivative of H. So the covariant derivative part has the partial part, and then it has these two gauge field terms. And then H itself, we're going to split up into a VEV part and a field part. And so if I want to, again, just like with the gauge bosons, I'm ultimately going to square this expression in the Lagrangian. And when I square it, I want only the terms that are quadratic in the fields. So that means that I'm only interested in the terms in D of H, which are linear in the fields. Because anything else will, when I square it, give rise to higher than quadratic terms. So how do I get linear terms, the terms that are linear in the fields here? Well, I could either get a term that's linear in the fields by taking this derivative times H, that would be linear in the fields, or I could take this, which is just a constant, times these gauge field terms. That would also be linear in the fields. But if I took, if I took the gauge fields times H, that would be quadratic in the fields, and when I squared it, I would only get cubic and it would only contribute cubic and quartic terms, so I can ignore it. Okay, so on this next line, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to just isolate just the parts of this covariant derivative that are linear in the fields. So this first term again comes from letting this d mu act on this h here, and then the second term comes from the gauge fields acting on V, I get this combination. So let me just take a brief aside to explain what I mean by that. So what did I do there? I took the gauge field part of the covariant derivative and the constant part of the scalar field here, and now I'm trying to multiply those out. So if I just expand out each of the Pauli sigma matrices here, well, sigma zero I've pulled a factor of I and a half and 1/√2. I've pulled that all out front here. And then sigma zero is the 2x2 identity matrix times B mu times G1. So I have a G1 B mu up here and a G1 B mu down here coming from that identity matrix. And then here, sigma one is the 1x1 is the Pauli matrix where it's ones on the off diagonal, so that's multiplied by W mu 1, so I get G2 times W mu 1 and G2 times W mu 1 on the off diagonals. If I take sigma 2, that's the matrix that's minus I and I on the off diagonals, so I get minus I W mu 2 and I W mu 2 down here. And then finally sigma 3 times W mu 3 gives me this W mu 3 and minus W mu 3 above and below. And those are now still need to be multiplied by the vector 0v. So if you just multiply that out, that 0v just selects the last column of this matrix. You end up getting this two-component vector, which is what I wrote. Which is how I got this expression. So now we are just going to take this. So this is ultimately some two-component vector of fields, and I want to take it times its dagger here. And so I just leave it as an exercise to you that if you take this vector times its dagger, the cross terms cancel. So what I what because because it's good exercise to check that the cross terms cancel. So what I get is this guy times its dagger. That's this term here. And I get this guy times its dagger. That gives me these two terms here. The cross terms cancel. So that's what we get by those are the quadratic parts coming from this term. What about the quadratic terms coming from this term, from the potential for the Higgs field? Well, we plug in, we're plugging in little h is equal to v plus big H here. And what happens? Well, if we plug this expression into the potential here, if you think about what happens, well, we'll get some terms that are zeroth order in H, that just involve V's. Those will just be constant terms. They'll just contribute to the cosmological constant. Those don't matter until we couple to gravity. And then when we do couple to gravity, we're just going to sweep those terms into the definition of the cosmological constant. Well, let's ignore those. Next, we'll get terms that are linear in the field H. But those should vanish at the minimum, because after all, the minimum is supposed to be a extremum of the potential. It's supposed to be a place where dv dh vanishes. So there should not be linear terms in H. So demanding here that the linear terms in capital H vanish tells us that the VEV, this constant V, it determines how it's related to the parameters M and lambda appearing in the standard model Lagrangian. So that's a good thing to check first. And then, if we then use that relation and now look at the quadratic terms in H coming from this expansion, we'll see that the quadratic terms are nothing but minus m squared times capital H squared. Okay, so that's a very good exercise to check. I just want to emphasize one thing here about going from the top line to the lower line, which is that in the original standard model Lagrangian, we had a plus m squared here. So in the potential, the Lagrangian is minus the potential. So the potential has a minus m squared in it in the original Lagrangian when it's written in terms of little h. But now the Lagrangian has the minus m squared. The potential has a plus m squared when it's written in terms of capital H. Physically, that's just corresponding to the fact that if we look back at the shape of the potential, we started here with little h. We were perturbing around this point. So little h was a tachyon. Its mass was unstable. Its potential was turned upside down. It was unstable. That's why we had a plus m squared little h squared appearing in the original Lagrangian. Now we're expanding about this point where the potential is concave up. So when we write it in terms of big H, which is the perturbation around the bottom here, that's why we have a minus m squared capital H squared appearing in the Lagrangian when expressed in that form. So that's why we have this minus m squared. I meandered for too long at the beginning about string compactifications, I'm afraid. Okay, so that's my fault. I did that. Yeah. So I'll finish this up next time. We're almost at the end where we extract that. It's now just once you've written things this way, it's just a matter of rewriting it in the diagonal form and comparing it to what the free particle Lagrangians should look like for scalar fields and vector fields. And what we'll learn is that. Just in this final line, we'll be able to read off that there are three massive vector bosons with masses given by some particular expressions, and the massive Higgs boson with its mass given by this expression, and then some massless vector bosons, a massless vector boson, the photon we'll see remains massless, but all the other bosons become massive, and then we'll do the fermions, which think heavens are a little bit easier and less gross. But yeah, there you go. There you go. It's a bit of a, as I say, I really encourage you to check these calculations on your own, because I'm sure it's too, it's a bit too much to take in without writing it out yourself. So, but it's actually very easy. Each of these steps takes just a couple of minutes. I really recommend if you want to understand what's going on. Okay, yeah. So I'll finish that up next time. And so again, I still think we're on pace to finish the basic standard model Lagrangian. I mean, and the rules of the game.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. So can we see at this level? Because I haven't understood what it means for the something eats the Goldstein bosons and the Higgs mechanism. Can we already through at this level of the calculation see that where that's happening?
Well, there's two different ways to do the calculation. One which makes the algebra simpler, which, believe it or not, is the way we've been doing it here. And then the other one, which is the way which makes that conceptual issue clearer. So the way that we have been doing it is to fix unitary gauge. So when you fix unitary gauge, it's basically
unitary gauge implies fixing how choosing a gauge that makes the Higgs field look like that, no? Zero on the first component and
exactly. This is fixing unitary gauge here. And so what we've done there is we've used our gauge freedom set the three Goldstone bosons to zero. So we've eliminated them from the theory, essentially. The three Goldstone bosons, remember, were the three other, you know, we started with this field that had four real numbers in it, two complex components. So how did we get rid of three of the scalar fields? Well, in this way of doing it, we used our gauge freedom to get rid of it. So now we only have one scalar field left in this expression. The other way to do it is to not use the gauge freedom and just look at the kind of you start with this more complicated Lagrangian that still includes all four scalar fields, but then you notice, oh, I can redefine a new vector field, which is a combination of my old vector field and one of those scalar fields. And if I work with that combined vector field, you know, the scalar field only ever appears in combination with that vector field. So if I define that new combined field, the scalar fields, those three scalar fields disappear from the Lagrangian, and then the vector field turns out to be those same vector fields turn out to be massive. So it's another way at coming at exactly the same calculation. It just lets you see more explicitly how the Goldstones actually get incorporated into those three vector bosons.
And H is a real field. It's not even a complex field. It's a
H. Exactly. H is a real field, and we'll see it's electrically neutral. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about the perturbative prescription you used here. So for Higgs, kind of you included the higher order terms to have this V plus H. But for the rest of Lagrangian, you want it to be in quadratic form, right?
So in the standard model, in the standard model, all the other fields, if you take their expectation value in the vacuum, their expectation value is zero. So the Higgs is the only field in the standard model where if you take the expectation value of that field, that field is some operator, and if you sandwich it between the vacuum and the vacuum and ask for what's the expectation value of that operator, it is non-zero. So it's the only field in the standard model where it has a non-zero expectation value, and that expectation value is just some number. It's no longer an operator because we've sandwiched it in between the vacuum and itself. So that's why just for that one field, we have split it up into its sort of constant part, its vacuum expectation part, and then the rest of it, which is this is an honest to God operator, just has the same status as all the other fields in the theory. It creates and annihilates particles. It changes from point to point in space. So the idea is that step one is after we split it up this way, we have to rewrite the Lagrangian and reassess, because our naive assessment of which terms in the Lagrangian were quadratic in fields and which ones were higher than quadratic is not right. We have to reassess after we've done this new, more physically correct splitting of the Higgs field. to determine what are the actual quadratic terms in the Lagrangian, where I count this field as being, I count this constant as being zeroth order in fields, but I count this capital H as being first order in field, as being a field just like all the other fields. So that's the idea. Is that clear? Clear?
We need all, I guess, to check these documents.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's no royal road. It's a bit of a, you know, what can I tell you? The laws of nature of the world have this slightly complicated. Oh, there you go. I encourage you to discover the better laws that are gonna require a shorter course to explain. Or to find a better way to explain it. I mean, that's the other thing. This is the best. Somehow, I. Anyway, there you go. Any other questions? All right. Very good. This is the darkest hour. We're almost through. It's if you just check these calculations and bear with it for one more lecture, then you'll know everything. You'll have all of human intellectual history condensed into you'll understand it all, and you'll come out the other side stronger, more compassionate person.